Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome everyone to Trisha's True Crime Radio. It is going to be an amazing show tonight, but first, we have to get gooey. Yes, it's time for our legal goo. Opinions expressed on Trisha's True Crime Radio are those of the hosts and guests. Do remember that, okay? Trisha's True Crime Radio is a completely separate entity from WebSleuths.com, LLC, and ForumsForJustice.org. In other words, my darling, wonderful friends, if you get your true crime brain all riled up, you don't take it out on the forums, you come to me, Trisha, in the Trisha's True Crime Radio title, and we'll try and work it out for you, okay? Big show today. Later in the show, we'll have former Boulder DA investigator and current Telluride, Colorado Police Chief James Kohler, along with Wild About Trials' Beth Karras. They are both going to discuss the blockbuster news in the JonBenet Ramsey case, the grand jury indictments. Thank you, hallelujah, it's about time. We'll be talking about that in just a little bit, but first up, it was 8 years ago this month, 8 years ago, that Terry and Darlene Anderson were brutally murdered in their home. Now, despite some national media, a reward, and constant hard work by the Anderson children, no one has been arrested for this crime. Joining us is Darlene and Terry's daughter and Web Sleuths member, Sherry. Sherry, thank you so very, very much for joining us tonight. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Trisha and Michael, for having me. I just want to just clarify that Terry was my father and Darlene was my stepmom.
Oh, okay. Understood. Can you tell us about them? Let's hear a little bit about them, about Terry and Darlene.
Well, my dad was just in his late 50s. He was actually going to be 60 just before he got killed. He was an avid fisherman. He loved to musky fish. He loved really any kind of fishing, ice fishing. And he reminded me a little bit of a cross between Santa Claus and Jerry Garcia. So,
I love that.
If you get a feel about that. He was a lot of fun to be around. He was very straightforward. He'd tell you how it is and this is it, you know, and deal with it kind of guy, you know. He was a recovering alcoholic for 16 years and drug addict, so he was a sponsor. You know, he was just a great person to be around. He was a very warm and very giving person, a great soul. Darlene was... She was such a sweet woman. She loved to go to garage sales, estate sales, any kind of little trinketry. We'd go up to the Angola and to the thrift stores up there, and she'd hit me up on all kinds of... She'd wear me out just running to all these places, and she'd come up with some really great stuff, too. And great cook, worked very hard. She was in her late 50s also, ready to retire, very quiet people, mind their own business, you know, just...
Right.
You know, just wonderful people, nothing,
salt,
no bother.
Salt of the earth, salt of
the
earth people.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there wasn't anything abnormal as far as their behavior. It was just normal, everyday Midwestern folk, you know.
Michael, my co-host, has a question for you. Michael, go ahead, please.
Hi, Sherry. How long were Terry and your stepmother married?
They actually celebrated their 25th anniversary the year that they were killed, because my dad bought her a ring.
Oh.
Yeah, so when my mom and dad, this was once upon a time in the mid-60s, my mom was still in high school, dad was just there too, and, you know, things happen, and had a couple little kids. My older brother Rick and I share the same parents, and he's in California, and he has his four kids. He's got an older son who's in the Army, and three younger ones, high school, junior high, and 10. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they were young. I was only one when my mom left, and then that was that. You know, I didn't know my dad until I reached out and found him with my brother when I was 18. So...
Mm-hmm.
I'm 40. I'll be 48, so it's been a long road.
You had some time. You've had
we had a really long, good relationship, at least when I walked in on him. I was already an adult, so it was a kind of a big change for him.
I'm sure it was, but thank God you were able to establish a relationship with him.
Absolutely.
Now, here we have your parents, the salt of the earth people, nobody, you know, let's face it, there are some people when you hear that they've been killed, you're like, wow, that's no surprise. These would be the last people on Earth you would expect this would happen to. Terry and Darlene Anderson, salt of the earth people, hardworking, lovely people. And I know this is painful. Even though it's been 8 years, I'm sure it's still as fresh as can be, Sherry. But what if you could just take us back to that day when the murder took place. Tell us what happened.
Well, my dad was in his pole barn. My dad and Darlene lived in a very rural town of Mongo, Indiana. It probably stacks about 300 souls there. That's it. Mm-hmm. So it's a very small-knit community. My dad and Darlene lived there for well into 30 years plus on that property. My dad was found in his pole barn, and the two big bay doors were closed, and he was bludgeoned to death from behind. And he was working on his John Deere tractor. I know this because he had a conversation with my husband just 2 days before that the John Deere's battery was not taking a charge, and sure enough, the charger was connected and such. So mm-hmm. Darlene was in the house, in the living room on the couch, where she was bludgeoned to death, and she actually seen the murderer come into her home because she had all her injuries were on her face, where my dad was on the back of his head on the side. So
Sherry, was this a robbery gone wrong, or was anything taken?
It was very little taking. There was some coins in a dish on my dad's desk in his pole barn. There was some weapons, an old resawed shotgun, part of a Horton, crossbow, and my dad just purchased it, and one of the pieces were still at the house, like the cranker or something of such, and it had a scope on it. So it was a nice piece of machinery. However, it didn't have all the pieces when it was taken. There really wasn't anything of huge value, Trish, that was taken. There was a saw in a box that was right next to my dad's body. There was Darlene's jewelry was never taken. Her ring that Dad just purchased was right there in the living room. She didn't wear jewelry when she worked. She worked in a machinery where she didn't have to. She couldn't wear jewelry, mm-hmm. So she put it in her in the coffee table in a drawer, and it was still there. So I don't believe it was a robbery that someone came there. I believe someone came on that property, welcomed, and had made a turn.
They came on, in other words, they were there. There was no suspicion between your father and stepmother, and then the vicious attack came. And it sounds almost like the stuff that was taken, like the person would know that stuff was there. I mean, who would ever think, you know, to take, like you said, that piece of machinery that for
well it was a,
you know,
it's a crossbow
even...
it was a very it's a very nice crossbow for hunting, but it didn't have all the parts to it to work. Mm-hmm. You know, you need to have certain pieces to it, and my dad did have a really nice handgun with a scope on it and a light that was taken. Mm-hmm. But the other shotgun that was resoldered like five times on it and had my dad's initials on it, those just doesn't seem to be any value whatsoever. If anything, that would be the worst thing to do, because now you've got something that's been resoldered with initials on it and very distinctively known to be my dad's weapon. So,
Sherry, we have a question from Michael. Go ahead, Michael.
Sherry, you spoke about you and your brother finding your father later in life. Did Terry and Darlene have any children of their own?
Yes, they did. When I met my dad, they had together, because my dad was his third marriage. My dad had a second marriage, and we have a another half brother, but he's not in the picture as far as anything that goes. But Darlene and my dad Terry had a daughter, Amanda. And when I met Dad, she was a toddler. She was probably about two.
Mm-hmm.
So when Dad was killed, she was about 20 years old. She was 20, actually, because that February she would have been 21.
So is
now,
that...
Oh, I'm sorry. I had two questions. I should have put two question marks.
Go ahead, Michael. You're fine. You're fine.
Did either your father or Darlene have life insurance policies?
They all have. They both had life insurance policies, and houses were paid for, cars, boats, 401ks. Oh, yeah. And
who ended up being the beneficiary of all those monies?
They did not have a notarized will. There was a will that was found, and I seen it in my hands, and I actually presented it to the attorney. It was a handwritten will, and I remember my dad and Darlene taking a trip up north to Minnesota on a fishing trip, and they hand wrote that if anything would happen to them, that, of course, everything would go to Amanda, which that my brother and I would never question because we're 25-year-olds, you know, over her senior.
Sure.
So I'm an established woman and married for 17 years, and, you know, I have a home and everything, and she was 20. So it said to, you know, everything goes to Amanda, but to share with your brother and sister, and it named me and Rick.
Mm-hmm.
The estate went into probate, so everything went into probate. But, Mike, eventually, after time went on, my sister did inherit everything, the house, the boats, 401K, the life insurance, everything, cars.
Sherry, this is not a pleasant subject, but when that happens, in any case, and when you know that the person who murdered, who was the murderer, was welcomed onto the property, I'm sure the police ask who benefits from Terry and Darlene Anderson's death.
Mm-hmm.
And I sounds like it was Amanda. What is the situation, if you don't mind me asking, what is your relationship? What's going on there?
To kind of touch on that, as far as the investigators, they don't believe that my sister was involved at all. So that's something that, you know, I still, after 8 years, I have a very hard time swallowing that. On just like what you're saying, there's a lot of history there in 8 years of behavior and a lot of things that took place. It's very difficult to talk about your blood and what had happened and to try to believe that. But I don't have a relationship with my sister anymore since then, and it wasn't just my choice. It was of her choice. So
I think, Sherry, if I may interrupt here, there's something to be said about just telling the truth and letting anybody else draw their own conclusions. Mm-hmm. And whatever that truth may be, as uncomfortable as it is the truth.
Yeah.
And if you don't want to answer this, I understand. I'm not trying to pry. I'm more just trying to understand here. You touched on the fact that there were, quote, behaviors, end quote, of Amanda's after the murder. Can you perhaps expand on that a little bit for us?
Well, 8 years is a long time, Tricia. So, and a lot of happenings took place. Example I could maybe give you is, in my eyes, Terry was my father, and I loved him so much. And I made a commitment when I came home from the murders. I came home to Chicago, and I had a life to live. I had a 2.5-year-old son, but yet I have two of the most beautiful people that were just bludgeoned in their home, and my whole life was just destroyed, and no one's under custody. So I was determined to find out who that was. My first instinct would be, why isn't my sister doing that?
Mm-hmm.
And
so in other words, there was no...
No,
no,
there was no nothing.
There was
in,
no,
in,
I want to find
eyes,
out.
Okay?
Right.
In my own opinion, in my own... I mean, no one has to jump on my bandwagon, Trisha, okay?
Mm-hmm. Okay?
They can do their own wagon. They can do their own run. They can do their own thing. But there was absolutely nothing being done.
Mm-hmm. Did she, Amanda had a boyfriend. Was there tension between the choice of Amanda's boyfriend and Terry and Darlene?
Yeah, there was tension there. And
what?
My dad worked actually close with Amanda's, and they all worked in the same tree service company. My dad was a supervisor foreman, so he would, he would tell people what to do because that's just mm-hmm. what he did. And my sister, she was young, and she was experimenting with a lot of things, and Quay just didn't seem, and that's Amanda's ex at the time, her boyfriend. My dad really didn't like his actions. My dad called him lazy, called mm-hmm. him, he just didn't like the idea that this guy was with his daughter. He just didn't seem to be the right kind of person for her. My sister was very energetic, smart. She was top of her class, graduating high school, and when she met him, she never wanted to go to college. She kind of just dropped everything and went a whole different direction.
Are they still together, do you know?
No. Actually, they broke up about 6 months after. I was very surprised at that. Super
surprised.
Yes.
Have you ever thought about talking to him one-on-one?
There is a couple times that I've tried to reach out. I don't know where he's at now. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm sure he's not hard to find. I'm sure the police know where he's at.
Mm-hmm.
Trisha, do you honestly think that he would really tell me anything? I really didn't have a great relationship with him as far
here's
as, like,
the thing.
Close.
Yeah, here's the thing, though. When people break up, they're usually angry at each other.
Yeah.
And they want to get even. And I'm not saying he would confess to you. I don't think he would.
Yeah.
But he might offer a hint. Just, I absolutely would check with the police first and say, I'd like to talk to him. Do you recommend this? Is this a good idea? And then see what they say. But I would try and reach out to him just because he might be mad at your sister and want to, lay some trouble on her. Now, that is a very dangerous slope to slide down because he might lie, too. Michael, go ahead. Your question.
Well, I'm just thinking if they were co-conspirators in the murder, just from the bludgeoning, it sounds like there would have to be some power. I don't know about Amanda's size. But when you think of a bludgeoning death, it's hard to imagine a woman having the strength to bludgeon a full-grown man and woman to death,
mm-hmm.
isn't it?
Yeah.
Or I don't know.
That's my first thought. When you said about this boyfriend, that was. And I'm not accusing anybody. We don't know.
I don't know that, Trisha.
Yeah.
And like I said, it's been 8 years now, and to bat around that idea for 8 years in your head when there's a lot of behavior that's very questionable, there's a lot of red flags in my eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And, I just feel that because of these lack of drive to find who and the why in the beginning
mm-hmm.
was my first
very
clue.
Suspicious.
Just the first interview that the police, the newspaper gave, because they interviewed Amanda just like the next day, and the only
mm-hmm.
thing that she basically said was she was going to put some new siding on the house and a wraparound porch.
Man.
And I'm thinking, and when I come home after, when it all happens, you're in a big blur, Trish. Really.
Sure.
All you're thinking about right now is, oh, my God, who would do this? You're not thinking about anything clearly. But when I got home, and this was October 31st, it was Halloween day, we got home and walked in the house. So it was 10 days after they got killed and I got the call.
Mm-hmm.
But that Thanksgiving, we get 4 days off. And I invited Amanda and my sister, you know, and her boyfriend over to the house, my house, and said, why don't you come out? I'll make a dinner. You can hang out. I expected to go back to the house and kind of help her with mm-hmm. things and cleaning it out or financial issues, the lawyer, whatever she needed. I was open to driving
sure.
back and forth there to help her. And I got a call that weekend because they denied coming out. And I got a call that weekend from a neighbor that was watching the house and said, hey, Cher, there's a moving truck in the driveway of your dad's. And I said, a moving truck? They said, yeah, someone's moving in to the house.
Oh, dear.
And I'm like, moving into the house? It's only been 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there was someone that moved into the house 3 weeks after. And this person was a complete stranger. I mean, I don't know how to take that, Tricia, when I mean, I was told, you know, I don't even know who this person is. And now I can't even go to the house.
Because there's a stranger there, right?
Now you've got renters there. And I don't even know who they are.
Oh,
well,
that
wasn't
is...
Amanda?
No, it wasn't her. It was from Amanda. Yeah, she allowed to have someone move into that house.
Oh, that's
a
just
stranger.
Awful.
So
oh, Sherry.
I had a bunch of my own personal stuff there because I had a 2.5-year-old baggage. I had Roscoe, who is a 150-pound, you know, bull mastiff that I took home with us. I couldn't take the things that I had there personally, like my husband's hunting gear. There was a lot of things I left there assuming we'd come back, and we never did.
Sherry, let's talk about the Facebook page that you have set up.
Sure.
Tell us the address of that, and let's get people to that Facebook page, and let's get this out of the cold case file into a hot case, okay? Your Facebook page, what is the address?
Well, I go underneath my dad's name. I thread underneath Terry Anderson, and I do also have a page, Justice for Terry and Darlene Anderson. So I actually have two pages. I would like to get it out of cold cases. I've tried to work with law enforcement. I've reached out to them and given them free tools like the VDOC Society. And,
oh, VDOC would be great.
They won't use them. They refuse to use them, Tricia. They refuse to use any outside sources, even free of charge. And I don't know why. It's because they don't want to use anybody. And
that's
these are
just
free
wrong.
Services.
That is just wrong. There's got to be something we can do. Michael, what's your question, my dear?
Well, actually, I have two. Sherry, what is the jurisdiction that is handling the investigation is one. And then the other, this behavior of your sisters, that Amanda, that you've noticed, have you been keeping whoever is doing the investigation abreast of the things you find so suspicious in her behavior?
Well, who has jurisdiction is LaGrange County. I mean, because of who was on the property and what was taken, ATF, FBI, state and local investigators were actually on the scene of the crime. However, who has the case is LaGrange County. And I've actually spoken to the prosecutor who actually is sitting on my dad's file right now, and it's just sitting there not being even worked on. As far as I know. So jurisdiction is LaGrange County, Indiana. And as far as the behaviors, I did at first tell investigators the questionable behavior, but as time went on, I was told I need to lay off because they don't believe that she had anything to do with it. So...
Oh, dear. And what's your second question, Michael?
Well, I did include them both, but I just had another one. Have you thought about hiring a private investigator to look into
well,
all
Well, I
of
have,
this?
But that costs a lot of money. That's a lot of money. I mean, that $20,000 is actually coming out of my pocket. It certainly didn't come out of my sister's when she had inherited money. She didn't even put a dime into it. So
the
$20,000 is my money that's out of my life insurance, my bank account.
Now you're talking about the reward, right?
Yeah, that's the reward. So any private investigator is welcome to collect on that $20,000, because I've looked into investigators. I've looked into them several times. Actually, when I first, when it first happened, my law firm that I work for in the city of Chicago, a very, very warm person that I work with, in his own dime, hired a private investigator.
Mm-hmm.
And I have what he believes, what his intentions are. However, they, again, he can't do anything if he can't see the file, Michael. If they're
right.
not going to let go of information that they only know, then you can't come down with a bottom line, because you're always going to have questions about this or that because you can't see the file.
Mm-hmm.
So LaGrange County is refusing to cooperate with
yes.
any outside investigators.
That's right.
And can you somehow, is Beth on? Is there a
no,
way
not
to
yet.
Legally, is there a way to legally
no.
force them to share those files? I would
uh-uh.
think
it's an open case, they said. Nope. I've already spoke to the prosecutor, and he himself told me in his own words, in the very words he told me, that I will not solve the case from where I'm at, meaning what I'm doing isn't going to do anything. And that really hurt me hard, because I believe that if I keep this case in the public eye, something's going to break. Someone's
mm-hmm.
going to talk. If I didn't, Tricia and Michael, no one would ever remember 8 years from now.
You're right.
No, this is just terrible. I was going to offer to have Tricia share my contact information if I could help you.
I can't get
secure.
Anybody. The prosecutor basically said, you know, you just better just leave it alone. You know, I don't know what.
Prosecution have,
yeah.
The prosecutor has someone they answer to, the district attorney. Have you tried talking
yeah,
to them?
Yeah, I've actually had other people work on that. And no one either calls me back or wants to even talk with me, Mike. So as a civilian and someone with not a lot of coin to work with,
mm-hmm.
you don't really have a lot of resources and a lot of tools, you know.
Sherry, I have some ideas, but I want to talk to you about them off the air.
Sure.
There are certain things that we can do to help, just to put a little pressure on. And let's talk about that off the air, because I don't want to put you in the position of having to say yes or no on the air and make a decision
sure.
right now. But give us the address, once again, of the Facebook page.
It's under Terry Anderson. I believe, yeah, it's Terry Anderson. And,
mm-hmm.
Again, I have a page that's Justice for Terry and Darlene Anderson.
That is...
And that's S-O-N?
S-O-N, yeah.
Perfect.
And
thank you, Michael.
And D-A-R-L-E-E-N.
Good. Yes. Thank you, Sherry. Thank you so much. We will have you on again. Hopefully, we'll have some news the next time you're on. But we do appreciate you coming on tonight. And anybody can go to websleuth.com and look in the cold cases. And we have a big section right there about Terry and Darlene. And you can read up more on this very tragic case. It should not be a cold case. And we'll see
no.
what we can do. Thank
I'm
you
so,
so
sorry,
much, Sherry. Thank you.
Thank
yes,
you, guys.
Please.
Thank you for having please. Me. And I appreciate any time, okay?
Okay, take care now.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Oh, that is just so tragic. That is...
My heart shattered for her.
I know.
She hit a roadblock.
Like that.
I want to
just like
that roadblock right down.
I know. Okay, we're calling Beth right now, and it's dialing, dialing, dialing. There we go. Let's see if this is Beth. Let's see what happens. Beth, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi.
Oh,
welcome,
wonderful.
Everyone. Welcome, Beth Karras. How are you?
I'm fine. Are we on the air?
We're on the air live. Yes, we are. Trisha's True Crime Radio. And, Beth, I know your time is limited. We're going to talk just a teeny, teeny bit about the McNeil case, and we're going to get into JonBenet Ramsey. And, Michael,
great.
I'm going to let you talk to Beth about the Ada and who is Ada's mother. And let's get into that. Michael, I'm going to turn it over to you for just a moment, okay?
Absolutely, yes. Hi, Beth, first of all.
Hi, Michael. Nice to talk to you again. Thank you so much for your donation. You are too generous.
Well, first of all, if you're comfortable, I would love for you to be able to share with the listeners about what you're doing for Covenant House. I think it's
yes,
so worthwhile.
Yes, let's talk about that.
Yes,
yeah.
Covenant House, homeless shelters across the country in a lot of major cities for teens, homeless teens, ages 16 to 21, I've gotten involved with the one in New York City in Manhattan. And I've been asked to be on the Legal Advisory Board, a newly created board that will go into effect in January to deal with emergency situations, legal situations. It's pro bono work, but I'm glad to be able to use my law education and my law license to help these needy teens. So the fundraiser I'm engaged in, and Michael was my first huge donor, is I'm going to be on November 21st. I'm going to actually sleep on the street overnight in New York City. One night, I know, is not like what these kids have to go through and other adults who are homeless on the street, but it is something that professionals are doing across the country, not just this one in Manhattan, to raise awareness and to raise money. So my goal is $5,000. I'm 70% there, and I hope that in the next 3 weeks I'll make my goal, and that will be, you know, that'll actually give a teen a month's worth of, or more than that, a month's worth of the facility, staying at the facility.
And how
that offers.
How do we donate, Beth, to your cause? That is such a great cause.
Yes. You know, I posted it on my Facebook page a week ago, but it's on my website, BethCaris.com, and there's a blog link on there, and so it's at the top of my blog. And you just link click on the link, and then it will bring you to the page, and you donate by credit card.
Fantastic. Oh, what a great
cause. Very
easy. That is wonderful. And we'll talk about it at the end of the show, too. But just briefly, we had a question last week about who Ada's mother was. Is that correct? Michael, tell us what you heard.
Yes, I reported last week that I was talking about a blog I had read that said that Ada was Vanessa's daughter, and I met resistance from our tremendous host, Tricia, and the guest at the time. And I, in listening to your fantastic spreecasts where you tell us everything we need to know, you mentioned that on a couple occasions that fact is actually true.
Yeah, and so, it has come out in the trial, Michael. It has been testified to now.
Oh, good.
This past week it was testified to. Vanessa is the mother. She is the second child. You know, there are four biological children. She's the second child. She had issues. We don't have the details, drug problem or something. We don't have the details. But I've done the math, and Vanessa must have been a teenager when she had Ada, and her parents ended up adopting Ada because Vanessa was just not capable of caring for herself. Now, there's information out there in the affidavit in support of the arrest warrant for McNeil, which is chock full of details that will.
Yes, I read it on your urging, and I couldn't believe it.
Right. Now, is it in that affidavit that after Michelle McNeil died, Martin McNeil allegedly, the jury will probably never hear this, allegedly told Vanessa he could kill her, basically put her out of her misery?
Yes.
Is that in the affidavit?
Yes.
No, okay. I couldn't remember.
I can't remember. I'm sorry, because I confused what I heard you say and what I read in the affidavit.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
But I know
it's in the affidavit.
He had wanted to, because of her drug problems, he offered to put her out of her misery. I believe I did read that in the affidavit, Beth.
Yeah, I just can't remember right now. He claims that he killed his brother. And
right.
when his brother was a teenager and they were living in New Jersey. And it is true that his brother died drowning in a bathtub, but
right.
One of his former girlfriends, Anna Osborne, she has a married name now, did tell the police, look, you know, he's admitted to lots of killings to me.
Mm-hmm.
Right,
before
he
Michelle
attempted
died.
To kill his mother.
Right, and that he found his brother with slit wrists in the bathtub. His brother was often attempting suicide. He didn't feel it was serious. He was trying to get attention, and he dunked his brother's head in the water and drowned him.
Oh,
that's
geez.
What he told Anna Osborne. And he said, and he also told her that he has killed patients of his. He's euthanized disabled patients. What disabled means he did not define. If it meant like a physical infirmity or somebody who was elderly or somebody who was just like terminally ill, I don't know. But that's what she claims he told her.
Now, Beth, one of the questions I had for last week's guest was, what would we not hear? because that is my pet peeve in trials, what is thought to be too prejudicial. And I was glad to hear you reporting that you have some of that information. And I think it, why would the judges choose to protect these homicidal maniacs is beyond me. But could you expound for the listeners here a bit on what
the
jurors will not hear?
Yes, well, the jurors will not hear some of this stuff we just discussed. Anna Osborne will testify, but only, she's only permitted to say that McNeil boasted to her that he knew how to kill someone and make it basically go undetected. And, you know, that's precisely what the state will argue he was doing here, and that he almost got away with it. Maybe he will get away with it. But Anna Osborne and the jury cannot say, and the jury will not know, about his statement saying he killed his brother, that he killed other patients, that he tried to kill his mother. Way too prejudicial, and that's the balancing test the judge has to do. Because, you know, the danger is that the jury is going to dislike him so much because of prior acts or at least statements that he of acts he claims to have done, that they'll convict him for those things and not the evidence in the actual, you know, killing of Michelle McNeil. So that's why judges will keep a lot of this stuff out. But I agree with you, Michael. It's frustrating. And when I was a prosecutor, I was always arguing that, you know, not in a murder case, but in other cases, like somebody, say, was a repeat robber or something, and the jury can't know about prior robberies, I would say, why does this defendant get the benefit of being an expert at sticking people up and stealing, you know, their property? He's an expert at it, and the jury can't know that. So, but, you know, usually prosecutors lose that.
That's just not right. I think it goes to show lack of character at a bare minimum, and the jurors need to know that. So what if they don't like him? He shouldn't be liked. What about their previous convictions and like leaving the daughter in the Ukraine so Gypsy
could
steal her?
Yeah, all of that also is out. The jury heard on Friday, because Gypsy Willis, the mistress, who supposedly, you know, the reason he did all this, she took the stand, and she's in the beginning of her direct examination. She'll resume on Tuesday. So she only was on the stand for about 40 minutes on Friday. But she admitted that one of the names she used in her life was Jillian McNeil. She has not given an explanation for that. They're not at that point in the questioning. But the judge has really curbed, you know, what she can say as well. Like, she did tell the jury that she has agreed to testify at all proceedings and will get a non-prison, non-jail sentence in a plea agreement. But the jury doesn't know what it's for. They don't know that it was through the because of the identity theft after Martin Mandel sent one of his Ukraine-born daughters to the Ukraine to visit a biological sister. He intended never to go get her. You know, Michelle's sister went and got her. She's back in the United States. But he intended to steal her identity, and Jillian ended up taking her Social Security number and then held herself out as Jillian McNeil. And they were falsifying, you know, they were stealing the identity, falsifying documents, and got busted for that. And that's why McNeil went to prison before he was charged with murder. And she, you know, apparently didn't do much time at all in a plea agreement, but it's all contingent on her testimony. Now, something that I observed in watching her testimony, I have not seen this plea agreement. It's actually a cooperation agreement, so I don't know all the details, but I've engaged in those myself as a prosecutor. Typically, again, I haven't seen this one, but typically those agreements are, you know, you can put whatever conditions you want, but one of the conditions is that you testify truthfully at all the proceedings you're needed at, and you have to cooperate, you have to be truthful. Well, I was really annoyed at what I heard coming out of Gypsy's mouth, because she's not exactly being cooperative. I mean, she has this selective memory loss. She is really downplaying the relationship. It's forcing the prosecutor, Pede, to use her prior statements that she did give the police. So, you know, they do have the details they need, and they need her on the stand to get this stuff out. But it's forcing the prosecutor to pull out these prior statement saying, well, didn't you, when you were spoken to by Investigator Whitney or Robinson or whomever she was talking to, didn't you say this? And she'd have to admit she said it was something more incriminating. But her actual testimony is not helping her. She's not looking exactly credible. But if I were the prosecutor, I'd be reading her or her lawyer the riot act, saying, look, I'm not going to honor this agreement unless she shapes up. She's going to prison.
Absolutely.
Unless she shapes up.
Can she be treated as a hostile witness for this behavior?
Yes. And
absolutely.
She can under New York law, again, I have to look at Utah law to see how they treat hostile witnesses, but the general rule is when you find that a witness is not exactly forthcoming, and I'm not sure that the judge would agree she's at that point, but I would think she's getting close. I mean, she was in a relationship with McNeil. She's the motive for the murder. She's not exactly up there, really helping the prosecution. She doesn't want to be there, I'm sure. But you have to make an application to the judge. I mean, I guess they could do it at sidebar. Maybe it was done already. Maybe by operational law, meaning she's automatically hostile. But he's not asking her a lot of leading questions. A hostile witness, you basically cross-examine them. Them as though you're on cross-examination. So you can kind of nail them on things if you need to.
Beth, I know Tricia wants to wrap this up, but I just have one quick question to put the cherry on the cake here. Beth, what did we miss on Friday? I haven't watched testimony from Friday. Who testified, do we know if Ada will testify?
Ada will testify next week. And only on Friday, you only missed the toxicologist and about 40 minutes at the end of the day of Alexis, because it was the judge's ruling on Ada, the toxicologist all day. Long direct, long cross. Bottom line, he said the drugs in her were, nothing was of a lethal level. However, the combination could have knocked her out so that, she either, drown herself or couldn't really resist. If she was drowning. I mean, he didn't say those exact words, but he said nothing was lethal, but it could have knocked her out. And that allows the state then to conclude, look, he could have held her head underwater or something, and she couldn't resist. And so that's basically what Gary Dawson testified to. And then it was Gypsy Willis. And she's just gone through sort of the beginning of their relationship, how they met online, and the communications, when things, heated up, basically March 2007, things were really getting, hot between them, and then Michelle's dead by April 11th. So she's really at about the point when she shows up at the temple a week after the funeral to meet Rachel and become the new nanny.
Beth, we do have to wrap this up because we have James Kohler on the phone, and I want to get your opinion as well on the new information in the JonBenet Ramsey case. But, Beth, you know we're going to be covering that McNeil case all over the place. So we'll definitely have you on again, probably next week if you're available, and to talk about what happened in the upcoming week's testimony, because I think it's going to be pretty explosive. Let's go to James Kohler right now, who has been very patiently waiting. James Kohler, Chief of Telluride, Colorado, the police chief, that is. How are you today, sir?
Good, Tricia. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. And Chief Kohler was the Boulder District Attorney's lead investigator into the JonBenet Ramsey case. He has since written a book. And Chief Kohler, tell us where you can get the book, the name of the book, and where we can find it.
Well, there's several different locations. You can purchase it from my publishing company, Ventus Publishing. It's on the web. You can search it that way. Or it's available through Amazon, both hardcover, paperback, and Kindle version. It's on Barnes & Noble, and I think bookstores sometimes carry it as well.
And it's called A Foreign Faction, Who Really Kidnapped JonBenet Ramsey.
Great book.
It is amazing. And Chief
Kohler.
And this is Michael James, Mr. Kohler, Chief Kohler. He's my co-host. He asks all the good questions, so he's the one that comes up with the smart stuff. But Chief Kohler, in his book, revealed his frustration at trying to do a correct and proper investigation into the murder of JonBenet Ramsey, only to be stifled at every move by Mary Lacy, just like her boss before her, Alex Hunter. Now, before we get into the grand jury testimony that was released, indictment, and to me, the indictments, the way they are worded, are explosive. We're going to get into those in just a moment, but Chief Kohler and Beth Karras, I do have a question for you guys, and this comes from a very loyal listener. She's been trying to ask this question for about a year now, and so I told her I would get to it first thing, okay? Now, everybody remembers that the DA's office in the beginning, when Steve Thomas was investigating the case, the DA's office stonewalled Thomas and the investigators. They were trying to get the Ramseys' phone records and credit card records, and they would just constantly stop them from doing it. Well, a husband and wife team, the Rapps, Mr. and Mrs. Rapp, R-A-P-P-S, they actually were able to get those records illegally, and they were going to sell them to the highest bidder, and it was everything that Thomas wanted. And Thomas said those records were walked by the Boulder police detectives working on the Ramsey case, and they were told, you will never get to see them. Okay? The question is this. James Rapp, they arrested him, and he pled out, and that was all closed a long time ago, for stealing private information. Could those records, if they still exist, now be obtained under the Freedom of Information Act or under a subpoena for investigation into the Ramsey murder? And let me, before you answer that, let me give you one little snippet here of why this is so important. Peter Boyles, he has a lot of inside information, and I think he slipped here and let something out that really did happen without realizing it. This comes from his show in 1998. He said, when the Ramseys are told they have their daughter, the two people who have control over their daughter follow our instructions. If you so much as breathe this to anyone, what's the first thing they do? Well, the first thing that Ramseys do is they call 911 after a call first to Michael Bynum. Now, this is what Peter Boyle said. He just was, you know, kind of talking about it. And he said, what do they do first after they get this ransom note? Well, after they call their attorney, Michael Bynum, they call 911. Now, there has never been any evidence to suggest that the attorney was called first, although a lot of people believe that because John Ramsey's cell phone records were wiped clean for December. Very interesting. Anyway, Chief Kohler, any chance we could get those records now, even though they were illegally obtained?
I'm not clear who has those records. So you're talking that Rapps have the records?
No, they were taken from the Rapps. The Rapps were prosecuted for obtaining them illegally because they were going to sell them to the highest bidder, to the tabloids. And it was the Boulder Police Department that took the evidence and said, you guys will never see these. And they were and the Rapps were convicted. He pled out, actually. And the records are there somewhere, even though they were obtained illegally. Is there any way we can get them now after all this time has passed? What do you think?
Well, this is my thought, and you probably have to get confirmation from a prosecuting attorney, but the exclusionary rule speaks to actions taken by the government, not by private individuals. So if those records were seized or collected illegally by the Rapps, and they were not acting as agents for the government, then the government, it seems to me, would be able to use or utilize those records should they choose to do so. If they've been collected illegally. If they had been collected illegally by Boulder Police or the DA's office or whatever government agency, then they would probably be excluded as evidence in a court of law.
I think that's what we were all thinking. And so they're sitting there gathering dust, and somebody just needs to go in there and look them up because I think they will be very, very telling. And one more question before we get into the grand jury testimony. This is for Beth Karras. Beth, do you know about the autopsy evidence showing JonBenet had been sexually molested before the night of her murder? This evidence is supported by half a dozen medical experts who looked at the record in the case through the years, including Dr. Cyril Weck. Are you familiar with this at all?
I am familiar with what Cyril Weck has concluded, and others have said that this was not a one-time assault, that the evidence of injury, vaginal injury, injury to, you know, she's a seven-year-old kid, to her hymen, did not occur in one incident. that there's there was absolute evidence of chronic abuse, not acute, not the one-time incident.
Exactly. So, Chief Kohler, even though this is an old case, is there a statute of limitations? Can't the prior sexual assault on a child be prosecuted now, or is it just can't be done?
There is a statute of limitations in that regard. You'd have to be able to identify who the actual perpetrator is, but I'm fairly confident that that statute is already run and you wouldn't be able to prosecute anybody for those offenses.
Exactly. Okay, thank you. That is for cold case. We've got it for you, darling. We have answered your questions, and thank you for being so patient. Now let's get on to the big explosive papers released, the grand jury indictments, the indictments that Linwood said and lied about, said did never happen, that Alex Hunter said there was no indictment, totally lied. John and Patsy Ramsey lying that there was no indictment. They lied. They make me sick. Now, I think the way it's worded is what is so explosive. I'm going to read the one. There's four counts here, four bills, two for Patsy and two for John. I'm going to start with John. It says, on or between December 25th and December 26th, 1996, in Boulder, Colorado, John Bennett Ramsey did unlawfully, knowingly, recklessly, and feloniously permit a child to be unreasonably placed in a situation which posed a threat of injury to the child's life or health, which resulted in the death of John Bennett Ramsey, a child under 16. And the other bill says, John Bennett Ramsey did unlawfully, knowingly, and feloniously render assistance to a person with intent to hinder, delay, and prevent the discovery, detention, apprehension, prosecution, conviction, and punishment of such person for the commission of a crime, knowing the person being assisted has committed and was suspected of the crime of murder in the first degree and child abuse resulting in death. Now, Patsy Ramsey's says pretty much the same thing. Here is the explosive part. Basically, what these indictments are saying, Chief Kohler, is they were helping somebody cover up what they have done. They, you know, Patsy was accused of helping somebody cover the same thing. You know, Patricia Paul Ramsey did unlawfully, knowingly, and feloniously render assistance to a person with intent to hinder, delay, and prevent the discovery, detention, apprehension, prosecution, conviction, and punishment of such person for the commission of a crime, knowing the person being assisted has committed and was suspected of crime of murder in the first degree and child abuse resulting in death. In other words, both parents are protecting somebody and hindering the investigation and preventing the investigation from going forward. They're protecting somebody. Who could that be? Am I reading this incorrectly, Chief Kohler?
No, I don't think you are. That was my same conclusion, specifically with regard to the accessory to crime, that by voting on that particular offense, that the grand jurors believed that there was some type of cover-up going on and that both parents had been engaged in trying to hinder and obstruct the investigation.
Beth Karras, is that your idea as well?
Yeah, first of all, let me tell you that it appears that there were indictments for each one. They weren't on the same indictment because each of them has the same count 6A and count 7. All right, so I don't know what counts 1 through 5 are, and I don't know why one of them is 6A. I've drafted many indictments in my life, and you just, you know, count 1, 2, or however, you know, however they label it. They use Roman numerals there. It's a little confusing. This is not the complete indictment. It's just two counts. Now, the count 6A for each one of them, two separate indictments or two separate documents, looks like it's the child abuse resulting in death, which would be a type of felony murder, I guess. But the accessory, count 7, for each of them refers to murder in the first degree and child abuse causing death. I don't know if there's a separate count for murder that was never disclosed. I'm a little confused. I think there was. So we don't have all the information. But more importantly, I don't think they know which one. If they believe the parents were involved, they don't know which one did it. Mm-hmm. So it was just like each one is covering up for the other. I don't know that there's like a third person that they're covering up for. They're covering up for each other. Do you agree with me, Chief Kohler?
Well, the way I read the information that was produced over the last few weeks was the judge, Judge Lowenbach, referred to 18 pages in the grand jury record, nine each referring to John and Patsy. And if you look at the numbering of the indictments that were signed by the foreman, you're looking, I think it was 4A and 7. And if you consider that each page was one particular charge, my conclusion is that there were nine potential charges that the grand jury was considering and only signed off on two, those being the same charges for each John and Patsy of accessory to crime and child abuse resulting in death. And so who knows what the other potential charges were that were considered at the time.
Got it. All right. I thought it's 4A. I thought it was 6A. I had my Roman numerals reversed. Okay. That's it. Okay.
To me, and I'm a layperson, and Beth obviously is a million times more knowledgeable on this than I could ever be, but to me it sounds like they were saying that there was a third person there and the parents were covering up for that third person. I don't think it was an intruder. It could have been Burke, in my opinion. That's what it looks like to me. Michael, you have a question.
Well, that's what I was going to say. That's how I interpreted it, was they were hindering the investigation because they were trying to protect a third party who was most likely their other child, Burke.
Mm-hmm.
Beth, do you think there's anything to that?
Well, I guess that's possible. He was so young. I just had a hard time wrapping my head around that. But I guess that's possible. Now, I know that...
How old was he at the time?
Wasn't he 10? Chief Kohler?
I think he was nine. He was nine. And Beth, you've got to read Chief Kohler's book.
I just looked it up on Amazon. I'll get it.
It has changed my view on a lot of things. And let's remember, everybody, Chief Kohler is the one that had access to the evidence. If you read when you read Chief Kohler's book, it's not going to be a bunch of conjecture and just opinions and, you know, things pulled out of the night. It's based on what Chief Kohler saw with his own eyes and investigated and worked hard on. It's all based on what he did as an investigator, as the lead investigator in the DA's office. He is the one, the go-to person that knows what was going on. That's why Chief Kohler's book is so important to this case, and everybody needs to read it because it will change things. Chief Kohler, you're about to jump out of your chair, I can tell.
Well, you're painting quite a picture, Tricia. I didn't have an opportunity to see all of the evidence. I tried to review those things that I thought were key components and important, crucial documents and reports. I considered my work to be an investigative treatise of the entire case as much as I could do objectively. And it outlines the evidence and points to a possible motive and opportunity for not only the commission of the murder, but also for the cover-up of the crime. And it's important to point out that you're not going to find an answer specifically where I point the finger at somebody. I do not try to spoon-feed the answer to the reader, but they are provided the opportunity to evaluate the same evidence that I considered as I evaluated the case and come to a conclusion as to the identity of the most likely perpetrator of the offense. And I think that was my job, to objectively get that out there so people could draw their own conclusions.
And you did an amazing job at that as well. Let's go to Michael. You do have a question, and then I have a follow-up question. Then we're going to take some phone calls. So, Michael, go ahead.
Yes, absolutely. Now, Chief Kohler, were you unable to also, as part of your investigation, review the phone records and the credit card statements that Tricia has talked about earlier?
There are phone records to review. They had never been obtained legally by the police department.
Why isn't that part of Investigation 101? I just don't understand how such a valuable piece of evidence could be overlooked, especially credit card statements and phone records. I don't understand that.
Well, I don't think it was overlooked because Boulder police were attempting to get those records, and they were denied when they presented affidavits for search by the DA's office. So, you know, it is Investigative Steps 101, but... in spite of
the
efforts of investigators, that's correct.
Oh, Michael, you gotta read about these DAs. You've got to read about they're unbelievable. We can't even go into it. It would, if I told you, you wouldn't believe me. It would sound like I was making it up. They were in bed with the Ramses, basically, in my opinion. Chief Kohler, I was lucky enough this weekend to go out with the Class Kids Foundation to do a big print-a-thon. This is where Mark Class goes out to a community. It was in Nebraska, and parents bring their children in, and they get their fingerprints and DNA kits, and Mark can talk to them about safety and simple safety things that you can do to keep your children safe. His daughter Polly was kidnapped and murdered 20 years ago this month, and Mark and I talked a lot about the JonBenet Ramsey case, and one thing he is interested in, and so am I, and I think a lot of people are too, and Beth, I don't think you know about this. Tell us about the picture of John and Patsy and Burke taken at the police station the day after the murder. Were he smiling?
You want me to talk about that? Okay.
Yes.
Sorry, I thought
you were
addressing that question to Beth.
No.
When the Ramseys had come in to the office voluntarily to submit to some handwriting and DNA exempt collections, they were each photographed with a Polaroid camera. And what struck me when I first saw those photographs was, you know, John looked very haggard and obviously distressed. Patsy, you could hardly recognize her from any of the other public photographs I'd seen. She's always very well made up and is very presentable in her public image. Burke was photographed in the same setting, in the same room, and he's leaning back kind of in a chair with his arm up over a table, and there was a smile on his face. It struck me as fairly strange, and I outlined a little bit about my impressions on that in the chapter called Enigma, when I speak about Burke Ramsey and some of the background about him in Foreign Faction.
Was he giving a thumbs up?
No, I don't recall anything like that. It was just the expression on his face.
Just a smile.
Thumbs up. Mm-hmm.
Just a smile. And that picture is not included in your book, right?
No, it's not.
Okay.
I didn't think it would be appropriate as a juvenile to put that picture in there, although I describe it. And this was a time, obviously, just a couple days after the murder, that everyone was very stressed out, in shock over the circumstances. And I couldn't fathom why the smile on this young boy's face.
Exactly. Let's go to one of our callers. This is, let's see here, is this Cynic? Are you there?
Hi, Tricia.
Cynic? Hi, this is Cynic. And Beth, before we get to you, Cynic, Beth, what do you think about that, about the picture of Burke Ramsey smiling, apparently in a good mood?
Well, I did not know that, and I find that disturbing. I don't know anything about Burke. I just figured he was just too young. I just had a hard time, believing that he would have anything to do with it. But Chief Kohler, is that kind of what you put out there in your book?
There's things that are presented there that were not in the record before that people weren't aware of. And I do a little bit of a analysis of some of the things that the DSS doctor spoke about when she interviewed him not long after the murder. Dr. Bernhardt interviewed him in January, within a few weeks of the murder. There were other things that came up during Detective Patterson's interview with Burke on the afternoon of the discovery of JonBenet's body. And then other things that were discovered at the crime scene, feces in JonBenet's bedroom and on some pajamas that were thought to believe to be worn or belong to Burke. Those are some of those things that I brought forth in that particular chapter about Burke's history there.
He was so protected from the public, wasn't he?
Yes,
I mean,
he was.
He was very protected. If he had something to do with that, they really went all out to protect him and lawyer up and make sure that they were protected, and it worked.
It worked.
That was
right.
One of the questions I had was that, why was Burke not considered a potential witness to this? Why was there so much effort to keep him out of the hands of police investigators to, question or interview him, and why didn't they ask him about what he may have seen or heard? They never did that.
Weird.
Strange.
And Chief Kohler, wasn't there feces also on some chocolates in JonBenet's room?
There was investigators, when they were processing the crime scene, observed what appeared to be feces on a box of candy in JonBenet's room.
Okay.
As well,
Beth,
as
I know. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Pajama bottoms.
As well as pajama bottoms. Beth, I know you have to go. And Chief Kohler, Beth has an incredible event that she's doing to raise money. Let's just touch on that for a minute before you go, Beth. What is it you're doing, and how can people donate to your great cause?
Well, go to my website, BethKaris.com, and on my blog, which is a link within my website, the first, the top entry has the link to donate if you're interested. I am involved with Covenant House, a shelter for homeless teens in New York City, but they exist elsewhere in the country, and I'm involved with the one in Manhattan. To raise money for the shelter, that shelter, like a lot of 501c3s, charities across the country, suffered in 2008 when the economy tanked, and they're still trying to recover from it. So the fundraiser that I'm doing, I'm trying to raise $5,000, I'm 70% there, is I'm going to sleep out on the street on November 21st in New York City. So I'm going to spend the night on the street like a homeless person, but I'll have a sleeping bag, like many of the homeless do, with other professionals, and I'm sure we'll be protected and all. It'll be safe enough, but it's just to raise awareness, and I'm going to take video and blog about it, my experience being on a really seedy side of Manhattan. It's not as bad today as it used to be, but it's really a seedy area.
Mm-hmm.
Beth, what is the weather like in November in New York City? Have you really thought about
it? Cold. It is going to be cold, trust me. But you know what? The city used to scoop up the homeless and put them in shelters, even involuntarily years ago, so they wouldn't freeze. I don't know that it will be freezing, but we've certainly had snow in November, although the climate changes and it comes later in the year, it seems, the last few years.
And, Beth, one of our callers does have a question for you before you leave. Sinek, go ahead, please.
Hi, Beth. Great to
Hi.
Talk to you, by the way. I enjoyed your work with Dominic Dunn on the Spectre trial.
Thank you. I miss Dominic.
Yes, so a lot of people do. The question I have is, I believe you mentioned felony murder a little while back when you were talking. My question is with respect to the Ramsey case. I know there were attorneys in the past that mentioned the possibility of using the concept of felony murder to bypass that troubling issue of, you know, if there's finger-pointing, cross-finger-pointing defense. What's your take on that? And specifically, let's hypothetically say that the Burke was the perpetrator, or the one that struck JonBenet on her head. And then let's say subsequently the parents did certain things, perhaps strictly cover up a patsy writing the ransom note, perhaps one of the parents staging with respect to the ligature around the neck and so on. Would not felony murder have sort of solved that troubling issue of who did what?
Well, okay. Felony murder is just another type of a theory of murder. There's intentional and then there's depraved indifference. Felony murder is simply engaging in a felony and a death results. And different states have only certain felonies that that have to be committed in order to charge felony murder. So, I mean, Chief Kohler, you know Colorado law. I'm not an expert in Colorado law, but the way I was looking at the few counts of the indictment that we saw, I thought maybe the child abuse was the underlying felony. It would not be allowed in some states in the country. Child abuse would not be an underlying felony. Now, I'm not really sure, though, this finger-pointing defense, you mean Patsy finger-pointing at John?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's the issue that the grand jury was struggling with.
Yeah.
And people have mentioned that before. Like, you know, was it
right?
You know,
I do too.
Who did what? The way I understand Colorado law is that there is one of the underlying felonies could be child abuse, but I believe the perpetrator has to be over the age of 10. So unfortunately, that would exclude Burke. However, Chief Kohler has also a theory of kidnapping in this case, and that's sort of one of the reasons why his book is titled the way it is, and that is that well, one of the speculations is that the crime was committed in one area of the house, in other words, the head blow, and then JonBenet was moved to another area of the house where perhaps other things were done to her, such as such as the sexual abuse and potentially the ligature strangulation. So if that was true, and then kidnapping was the underlying felony, then felony murder could then perhaps be a potential charge still?
Yeah, I guess it could. But, you know, you really do have to know what everyone did. And you know, and if anyone is helping to move her after she's dead, then that's not being involved in a murder. So, you know, it's very complicated. I really don't know. I can almost understand why the indictment wasn't signed because, you know, I don't know enough facts to know how they would have proven who did what unless they said everyone's in cahoots and you're all responsible for each other's actions because you all acted with the same state of mind, the same intent. But, you know, I don't know if there's evidence that, you know, where she died. Did she die, you know, in the bedroom and then she got moved dead, or did she, you know, was she alive when her body was moved? I don't know. All this whole discussion, of course, ignores what Mary Lacy said in 2008, that the Ramseys are absolutely exonerated. Just, you know, that should probably be thrown in here for the discussion only because John Ramsey has this really intense lawyer who will come after anyone who is going to defame him.
Well, let me just say real quickly, Chief Kohler, have you heard from Lynn Wood when you wrote your book? Have you heard from him yet?
No, I haven't.
That means to me there's a lot of truth in that book. But Beth, you're right. That guy will come after you, even though he's been proven now to have absolutely completely lied about the Ramseys not being indicted by the grand jury. Beth, we love you, and we are going to get as many people as we can to donate to your great cause. And you're also on wildabouttrial.com, and you're everywhere, and we love it. So, you know, you're welcome back anytime, and I'm going to have you on, and we're going to take 3 hours with you one night, young lady, and that's all there is to it.
Okay, that's great. I just was contacted by Dateline today, so they'll be doing the McNeil story, and I think they'll be interviewing me for that, so I'll let you know.
Wonderful.
Oh,
okay,
wonderful.
Thank you.
Hey,
that's
Beth,
great.
I wanted to say, I heard in the Spreecast where you talked about penning a book. Are you writing a book?
Yeah, I'm starting to outline. I'm batting around some ideas. I talked to a book editor, a publisher last week. So, yeah. I mean, it's a long process doing a book. Jane Blaise Mitchell got one out really fast in the Arias case, but there were five of us working on it. So if I do a book by myself, Chief Kohler knows, it doesn't happen mm-hmm. overnight. So it is something I'm beginning, though.
For
yeah,
sure.
I will be writing.
Can you tell me what it might be about?
Well, one book will be about basically the rise and fall of a brand called Court TV. It's going to be, you know, mm-hmm. my life in the trenches. So it'll be some of the stories that I don't talk about on TV, you know. Mm-hmm. That will be one of them. Another one will be a crime book, a case I'm looking at. So that's the beginning.
Wonderful. This sounds so good. Well, Beth, thank you. You've stayed
on the homeless shelter issue.
Pardon me?
Good luck on the homeless shelter issue. That's a worthy cause. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Beth.
Okay.
Thank you, Beth, and
take
you
care.
Stayed on a
I'll
lot longer, and I appreciate it. Okay, thanks, my dear. Take care now.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Oh,
I love
Beth. I know. She's so wonderful. We always say those same things about you, Chief Kohler, too, when you go. We always say we love him. He's wonderful. Chief Kohler, do you think is next? I mean, is this like with everything in the Ramsey case? Everyone's going to be outraged and talking about it, and then it's just going to go away. Do you think the current Boulder PD, Stan Garnett, has the kahunas to do anything? What are your thoughts?
Well, I've been contemplating this over the last few days. I did an interview with CNN early yesterday morning. MSNBC wanted to try to get me on Friday, and I had some internet difficulties, and I kind of jotted some thoughts down today before your show today. And essentially, I think that the release of the 99 documents of John and Patsy Ramsey provides, you know, some insight into the historical events that were taking place during the grand jury mm-hmm. inquiry into JonBenet's murder. You know, for 13 months, a group of 12 grand jurors sat through the presentation of lay witness, expert witness testimony. They viewed crime scene photographs. They evaluated evidence and contemplated the motive behind the alleged, you know, kidnapping and murder of a six-year-old child. Based on the record we already talked about, it looked like there were 9 potential charges that were being considered for both parents. The grand jury foreman only signed 2 of those, so the indictments were never co-signed by them, you know, District Attorney Alex Hunter, nor was their existence ever made known to the public until now through Charlie Brennan's efforts. Hunter instead concluded the grand jury process by holding a press conference stating that there was insufficient information to file charges against anyone involved in the murder, and that, I think, left everyone with the impression that the grand jury had taken no action.
Mm-hmm.
The statute of limitations for those charges was 3 years, and it was told by another 5 years when the family left the state in Colorado. Had the indictment been signed by Hunter or his successor, Mary Lacy, the Ramseys could have been charged up until Christmas of 2004, and that obviously didn't happen. Obviously, as people have noted, the opportunity to prosecute these charges is no longer a viable option, and the release of these documents doesn't really move the investigation of the case any closer to any actual prosecution of the person or persons responsible for the murder or for the cover-up, as, you know, we talked about the accessory charge.
Mm-hmm.
People talked about Lynn Wood, and, you know, Brian Morgan has reentered the scene. They've indicated that the release of these historical documents is unfair, does nothing more than to add to the speculation about the case. One of the articles I was looking at this weekend, Lynn Wood was quoted as saying, "What you have is nothing more than confusing accusations without any evidence to support the accusations." And he says, "Let's see the evidence." And they were arguing that the entire record of the inquiry should be made available to the public, not just the official action of the indictments that were voted upon by the grand jury and signed by the foreman. My perspective is, you know, what seems to be missing in the equation, as Wood sees it, is the realization that, in essence, the grand jury heard not only from the prosecution and the police who led the murder investigation, but also from the primary advocate of the intruder theory, who was Lou Smith.
That's right.
If you recall, Smith sued the DA's office in February 1999,
mm-hmm.
the right to maintain custody of crime scene photos and other evidence that he had taken with him when he left the DA's office under protest in September 8, 1998. He believed at the time that the prosecutors had developed tunnel vision and were focusing their suspicions only on the parents of John Binet. He was successful in his lawsuit, if you recall, and according to the Boulder Daily Camera that published articles about this in the time frame, he testified before the grand jury in March, actually on March 11, 1999, as it was reported.
Mm-hmm.
So he also then subsequently presented his intruder theory to the national audience on a series of programs hosted by Katie Couric of the NBC Today Show. Wood reportedly encouraged Smith to take his theory to the public through NBC and indicated that he'd be calling Smith to testify on some civil actions that were pending with the Ramseys at the time. I think one of those was with Chris Wolf in Georgia. So my counter perspective is this, and that is that the grand jury heard the entire presentation of Lou Smith's intruder theory when he testified before them in March of 1999, and in considering that evidence and his theory, they still voted to indict the parents on 2 criminal counts of child abuse, resulting
mm-hmm.
in death, accessory to a crime. So it's clear to me that by the accessory count, the grand jurors felt the parents had participated in some type of cover-up and attempted to hinder the investigation. You know, presumably, if Hunter had signed the indictment and decided to officially charge the parents in that case, Smith would have, in all likelihood, been called by the defense team to cast doubt on the parents' involvement. You know, having said that, jury trials are a complicated process. You know, both the prosecution and the defense get to vet their cases and cross-examine the witnesses who testify for the other side in front of either a judge or a jury. But the point to be made, I think, is that while the grand jurors didn't have the opportunity to evaluate the type of testimony in an adversarial trial setting, it appears that they most assuredly heard from the most influential proponent of the intruder theory, Lou Smith, and they
mm-hmm.
still found probable cause to indict the parents on those 2 charges. I think that they carefully evaluated all the evidence that was presented to them over the course of 13 months. And after thorough deliberation, they voted on two counts that they thought could be proven. As I think was mentioned by Beth, I have no doubt that they would have preferred to have indicted the actual perpetrator, but it's my guess that they just couldn't determine who that specific individual was. You know, I mentioned in one of my chapters that the assistant DA had indicated that they really hadn't taken a close look at Burke Ramsey at the time. And So I do believe, based on Lou's statements, that the focus for the grand jury seemed to be on the parents, and that, you know, Burke's possible involvement in this was not really being considered or explored at the time. And so a lot of the things that I discovered during my review of reports and transcripts and interviews and things like that perhaps were never even considered during the investigative process when Boulder PD was in charge of the case.
Wow, that is very compelling what you just said, and I thank you for putting it all in perspective for us. And as they say in they're saying in the chat room, Chief Kohler, let's give Linwood what he wants. Let's release everything. Don't you think that's a little bit of him pounding his chest, knowing that that's not going to happen?
I don't think, you know, this is all kind of new law, if I read the articles correctly, that there's never been this type of challenge to release documents from the grand jury.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, I'm not sure that, you know, Linwood or any of the defense attorneys really knew that perhaps these indictments had been returned. You know, once they came back and Hunter led the public to the impression that nothing had been done, that the grand jury failed to indict, then I think that emboldened the Ramsey team and Linwood to go after people who were believed to be libeling the reputation of the Ramseys, and that's what generated some of those lawsuits, I believe.
And what's interesting is I wonder if those people can now go back and get their money back, because the Ramseys, you know, were indicted. And so that is something that I think possibly could happen. Let's go to Cynic again. Cynic, you have a question and a comment concerning Linwood.
Yes. Well, not only did Lynn make these comments in terms of getting, you know, saying, well, let's let it all out there and let the public decide. He also said that prior to all this. As a matter of fact, he said this back in the year 2000. I could just read a little brief section here. This is an interview, and Lynn Wood and Mike Kane are on the same interview. And this is a little bit of back and forth between them. Linwood says, Mike Kane, why don't you just tell us why the grand jury didn't take any action? It's a fair question. The public is entitled to know. Mike Kane, well, I'm not going to. I'll tell you what, Mr. Wood, I'll tell you what. If you will go to court with me and ask the presiding judge to authorize the release of that information, I will release it. Linwood answers back. He says, I will walk into that courtroom with you. Kane, I will sign that petition with you, Mr. Wood. Let's go, let's get this case. And then Larry King just intervenes a bit. Linwood, let's get this case out fully and fairly before the public. Larry King says, we have made some progress here tonight. Linwood will release all the tapes he's got, and Mike and Lynn will go to court together, and Lynn will ask for the release of the grand jury testimony. Mike will say it's okay. Linwood, I look to seeing you in court, Michael. Kane, I will tell the judge I have no objection. If you say that you will waive rule number 6, and allow us to release that information, I'll tell the court I have no objection. Now, the response to all this, it didn't happen, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Right,
otherwise,
right.
Otherwise, otherwise Brennan wouldn't have been going through any of what he's going through, because he not only had the indictment, he'd have everything. What happened was, and there's a little statement here, Alex Hunter steps in, and he says the following. This is Associated Press, September the 1st in the year 2000. Alex Hunter, he says, Mike Kane and I agree that Rule 6.2 of the Colorado Rules of Criminal Procedure does not permit release of grand jury transcripts or any discussion of what a grand jury did or did not do. The rule clearly states that grand jury proceedings are secret and shall remain that way, and get this, until either an indictment is returned or report issued, and neither of that occurred.
Oh, so he's lying right there.
Totally. And as I
big
said,
big lie.
I can understand him saying, well, you know, I have no comment about this grand jury testimony is mm-hmm. secret, sure, remain that way. But he didn't just leave it there. He went well out of his way to lie totally. And I mm-hmm. want this guy to be held accountable for this. This is ridiculous.
Chief Kohler, what can be done? I mean, he's just proven a liar. Is that all that we can do now? Is that, okay, we have absolute proof now he lied, even though we all knew he lied before. Is that all that can come of this for Alex Hunter?
Well, he's not lying under oath in any official proceeding, you know.
mm-hmm.
So I guess the comment would be that, you know, anyone can lie to the media.
Actually, can I interrupt?
Right.
Can I interrupt there?
Sure.
That's actually not
sure.
true. Okay, not only do we have him there, but in the lawsuit between Linda Hoffman Pugh and Alex Hunter, which was then carried over to Mary Lacy, the following is in the actual court record. It says Linda Hoffman Pugh intends to write and publish an account of her story as a housekeeper who worked for a family whose daughter was murdered. Part of her story will include her appearance before the Boulder grand jury, whose term has ended without an indictment or report, and it will recount her testimony before the grand jury investigating the death of her employer's daughter. And that statement stood not only with Alex Hunter, it also stood with Mary Lacy. So there it says that the grand jury's term has ended without indictment or report. Now, again, it wasn't a statement under oath, but it was an official document. You know, it went through several cycles of court proceedings. As a matter of fact, all the way to the Court of Appeals, and it wasn't corrected.
Well, is that something the media reported, or is that something that
no,
is
that,
attributed
that's an
to
official
a statement
document.
From Hunter?
That's
oh,
an
really?
Official
okay.
document in the courts, yep.
Yeah,
and it was
yeah,
used
I remember,
in a court case.
I remember hearing that, you know, Linda had attempted to get permission to talk about her experiences, but I really never really researched the materials on that lawsuit. It seemed to me that he went to extreme lengths to try to prevent any of that information from being released.
Exactly.
So
what can be done?
What do you think can be done? Do you think anything can be done?
That's more of a question for a prosecutor than it is for me.
I know, but we loved hearing from you. It's just, I guess it's just so frustrating because, you know, we want answers. We want somebody held accountable for something. You know, it's all there. It's all out there. No, we don't know exactly what happened, but we know there was a lot of lying going on and covering up, and things were done improperly and were absolutely against the public interest. And I think that's the frustration. That's why we've all hung together for so long, is we're just waiting for something that looks like justice. Sinek, go ahead, please. I need to call back my co-host. He has disappeared on me. So I'm going to give him a quick
sure.
call. You go right ahead, okay?
Okay, well, James, I have another just sort of a comment with respect to all the way the mainstream media has been handling this, outside of the fact that they contacted you, which is great. But generally speaking, there's been... so much information that's been tremendously frustrating to me, although it's, I'm sure, not as it's even more frustrating for someone such as yourself. But a number of points that they seem to be harping on. One of them is that, of course, the probable cause versus proof beyond a reasonable doubt, and, you know, Alex Hunter, you know, did the right thing ultimately. And then they follow that up usually with saying that, well, you know, he did the right thing because even though it wasn't present at the time, DNA evidence, you know, as in the possession of Mary Lacy would ultimately vindicate the Ramseys or exonerate the Ramseys and so on and so forth. Those two points seem to be the kind of the two biggies that that they seem to continually focus on. One thing that there's so many things that they should have looked at and didn't, and that's down to laziness more than I think than anything else. For one thing, Alex Hunter's reputation as a DA and a prosecutor was certainly less than stellar. He's a notorious plea bargainer. He'd done some very unusual things with some cases. especially the case where the Smyka case, where essentially a deal was made that there was going to be a grand jury, but there was not going to be an indictment. That's not mentioned. Then, of course, the whole DNA aspect there with Lacey, they sort of just rattled that off as an absolute fact. They ignored the evidence that you put forth in your book about the six unique and unidentified genetic profiles. They never contact an independent DNA expert to sort of have an actual comment on this. And I'm thankful for the fact that Tricia gave Dr. Dan Crane an opportunity to speak to that evidence on her show. And he said that if Mary Lacey exonerated or cleared the Ramseys based on that evidence, which he actually says is it would be inadmissible in court because they are partial and mixed profiles. He said that if Mary Lacey did that, that conveys a lack of understanding of DNA. But these are things, unfortunately, you just simply never hear in the mainstream media. And, you know, Sam, I'm sure it must be quite frustrating for you. Any comments or anything that's really, you know, struck you as you've listened to the media circus?
I have to say that's a very loaded question, Cynic.
That is.
Actually, I like them, yeah.
That is that's a cannonball.
Shotgun blast. Mm-hmm. I had an opportunity to listen to Dr. Crane's the program. Actually, I listened to it today, and I thought it was very enlightening. And it's too bad, like you say, that that stuff doesn't get out to the mainstream media. I mentioned the six different DNA profiles during the CNN interview on Saturday morning, and I haven't heard anything more about that. And I think it's pretty important that, you know, folks like Dr. Crane and other DNA experts, you know, weigh in on that, perhaps if they're asked to talk about, you know, exactly how probative that DNA evidence is. It's microscopic, it's degraded as far as the distal stain 007-2. I think there's opportunities to explain that, and the Ramsey team seems to continue to say, well, we'll find the perpetrator when there's a DNA match. And my thought is that if there's a DNA match, it's going to come back to a 10 or 11 or 12-year-old kid that was in a sweat factory overseas manufacturing that underwear, and he's never been probably more than 10 miles from his own home and never set foot in the United States or on this continent.
That's right.
And I think that if people continue to look at that evidence and exclude anything else that points to other involvement outside of an intruder, then they're misconstruing the evidence that's out there in this case. And I've heard that there's been prosecutors out there, maybe a handful, that would have liked to have been able to take a challenge at prosecuting this case, that maybe they believed that there was evidence here that was probative and beyond a reasonable doubt. But Alex Hunter's track record would indicate that he just wasn't willing to do that. And I really found enlightening Stan Garnett's op-ed today that he offered. And I have to tell you, I have a lot of respect for Stan Garnett. I don't know him very well, but in the first year or so of his taking office in Boulder, they prosecuted five felony homicide trials, winning all of them. I think he's gathered an excellent staff, and they're willing to go to trial and go to bat for things that I think that Alex Hunter's office never was willing to do. They were always wanting to plea bargain things. And I've said this on a number of occasions before. I said, you know, where was Stan Garnett when we needed him in 1996?
Boy, that's the truth.
If he, you know, would have been around at that time, I think we might have seen a different conclusion, but unfortunately that was not the case. And he didn't have an opportunity to even file on these charges because the statute had run before he came to office. So,
Chief Kohler, we do have some
observations.
We do have some questions from the chat room, and it does have to do with the things that you wrote about in your book, and a great book, everybody. You've got to get it. it's a foreign faction who really kidnapped JonBenet Ramsey by Chief James Kohler. Chief Kohler, you talk about the partially unwrapped presence in the basement. Do you mention in your book that these are significant? If so, why?
Well, I proposed one theory about the Secret Santa information that came forth. People kept thinking that that was a person, and I thought that it was possible that was an event. You know, the family was going to Michigan, to Charlevoix, to celebrate a second Christmas with John Andrew, the older brother. I can't remember who else was going to be going to that. And, you know, JonBenet was telling people that she was going to be receiving a special present from Santa afterwards. And people interpreted that as being, you know, the perpetrator who came in and murdered her because he was bringing her a secret present. And I thought that those presents might have been involved in the second Christmas and the other special present that he was going to be giving to her with the Michigan celebration. That was just an alternate theory of events. You know, why would those presents be still in the cellar the day after Christmas if perhaps they had not been intended to be transported to Michigan?
Right.
It just didn't make sense to me. So the same wrapping was observed on presents under the Christmas tree, and it was my thought that those perhaps were the one or more of the special presents maybe were intended for JonBenet as well as Burke when they got to Michigan, where another, you know, Christmas would be celebrated.
And that could be your Secret Santa. That certainly makes a lot of sense. Chief Kohler, we touched on Linwood a little bit. Linwood is the attorney for the Ramseys. He's been called a pit bull, and he was a pit bull and still is for the Ramseys. He successfully sued people who said anything about Burke Ramsey. But one thing I want to remind people of, and this is very important and it's very interesting, and it is the back and forth in a fax between Linwood and Alex Hunter, D.A. Alex Hunter, when they were trying to come up with the wording of clearing Burke Ramsey. And Linwood, we have that fax. I believe it's in your book, if I'm not mistaken, Chief Kohler, if I remember correctly. We have in that fax, it says, Linwood wants to basically say, there is no evidence to indicate Burke Ramsey is involved, or words to that effect. But Alex Hunter, he did do one thing. He changed it a little, and he said, there's no evidence to suggest that Burke Ramsey was involved at this time. So they left a little teeny bit of a door open. And this is going to be a hard question for you to answer, and you're going to roll your eyes and think, I'm never doing this show again because I don't like these questions, but here goes, Chief. So get ready. The little bit that you have become aware of Burke Ramsey, do you feel just maybe in your gut that someday he might come forward and tell us what he knows? That's what I'm hoping for anyway.
That's very hard to say. You know, you refer to as an affidavit that Wood was trying to get Hunter to sign for use in evidence in a case, a civil case. I think it was the Wolf case that was being defended at the time. Mm-hmm. In Georgia, so we wouldn't have to call Hunter to the stand. And Hunter edited some of the things that Wood was trying to put in his mouth. You know, I besides covering the DNA evidence on the CNN interview Saturday, also suggested that one additional step that might possibly be taken by Boulder PD and the Boulder DA's office was to call Burke Ramsey to the grand jury and question him about some of the discrepancies in his prior statements. He's only given three statements. One was to detective to a detective on the afternoon of the discovery of JonBenet's body, very short interview when he was at the White residence. The other was during the DSS interview on January 8th, 1997, if I recall the dates correctly. And then in 1998, when the grand jury was looming, he was interviewed over a course of two or three days by Detective Schuler with Broomfield PD. And in my review of those statements, there were some inconsistencies that I think arose, and I would like to be able to see him question further on those. Mm-hmm. In 2009, after the cold case task force met, when the DA handed the case back to Boulder PD, there were some thoughts about follow-up conversations, and it was reported that Boulder investigators had gone and knocked on Burke's door to, you know, see if he had any new revelations or any thoughts to add, and he turned them away at the door and declined to be interviewed. He had no questions as, you know, whether or not they developed any other suspects, where they were on the case. He just flatly refused to interview with them. They subsequently got a letter from, I think it was Lynn Wood, that said essentially, leave Burke alone. Well, I'd like to see a subpoena issued for him and ask him to speak in front of a grand jury. In all honesty, I can't say that that would lead to any positive results, but it's one last step that perhaps Boulder PD could take to see if they could bring resolution to this case, even if charges couldn't be brought.
Right, and Chief Kohler, that's a very logical and very realistic suggestion. That's not something that, you're not going off on a wild goose chase here. Why can't they subpoena Burke Ramsey? Why wouldn't Stan Grenett do that? I don't understand. What would stop them? What do you think would stop them from doing this?
Well, this is the issue, I think, is, you know, there's been well over $2 million on taxpayer dollars spent on this investigation. That alone was what Boulder PD spent on it, even before it went to the DA's office when Mayor Lacey was in charge. Mm-hmm. I expect that they probably spent more money since then. Would this result in an indictment for murder? No, probably not. Would it result in any criminal charges being brought? No, probably not. Could it result in a resolution or conclusion definitively? Maybe, but I don't know what the percentages of that would be. But, mm-hmm. you know, rather than sitting back and waiting for some revelation or someone to come forward to say, hey, this person confessed this to me, it might be just one last step that would, you know, be, I think, possible to take that might bring resolution to it. It could
and
be done without having to do 13 months of investigation. It could be done maybe within a few weeks or a month. With just a little bit of effort.
That would be amazing. Let's go back to Cynic. I'm going to check the chat room here, Cynic, and I'll turn it over to you for just a few moments. I know you have stacks and stacks of questions for Kohler, James Kohler, and we're not going to get to all of them. Don't worry, Chief. We're not keeping you here till midnight. We do have questions in the chat room. I'm going to gather some of those, and Cynic, you go ahead.
Okay. Let's see. Where am I in my stack of questions here? Bill Weiss had a little interview in either late January, early February, when Charlie Brennan first broke the story with respect to the grand jurors speaking and him indicating that there was an indictment. So I can't remember. I think someone with the Daily Camera interviewed Bill Weiss, if I'm not mistaken. And he had a couple of interesting comments throughout in the course of that interview. One of them was, I would say that there was not unanimity or a unanimous decision by anyone, Weiss said. I know of at least one and possibly two prosecutors who felt it should have been filed, period, end of discussion. And I know of at least two, if not more than two, probably four, that thought that there was not enough evidence to file. When you have a true bill that says two people were involved, but it does not say what the involvement of the people was, all a good defense attorney has to do is to separate their trials, and then all of a sudden you've got nothing, Weiss said. You're operating under the theory that two people might have been responsible for the death, and when you separate them, you don't know which of the two people is responsible for what, and I thought it was the right decision. Some of the latter stuff I wasn't really focusing on, but it was interesting that despite what the you know, the media indicates that, oh, you know, what a courageous decision by Hunter and so on and so forth. It doesn't sort of get into the nitty-gritty that, you know, there was a prosecutorial team, and there's, you know, and as Weiss indicates, it was certainly not a unanimous decision to not go forth with the indictment. I thought that was interesting. Have you heard that before?
You know, I can't say, Cynic, that I've actually seen that interview. It doesn't surprise me, you know, from what I've had related to me was that whoever they were, there were some prosecutors who felt like they would be willing to go forward and charge the Ramseys, not necessarily on the indictment, but maybe on the murder charges. And then those who, you know, worked in the Boulder DA's office who didn't feel that they could present a case as such. You know, I think it all comes down to the experience and the outlook of the prosecutors, what they think the evidence is, how they can present it, how they can argue the case, and as to whether or not they think it can be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. And, you know, some prosecutors are going to disagree on what they think is beyond a reasonable doubt and others that don't think it's there. So I think probably what he's commenting upon is true, that some of those people that were being consulted with would have liked to have gone forward and charged.
Chief Kohler, we have a couple of questions from the chat room, if I could just jump in here real quickly. Do you know what was actually in the cellar in those presents and in was there a doll down there? Do you know any of the contents at all?
You know, the presents had been torn open partially so that someone mm-hmm. could see what the packaging was beneath the wrapping. Someone on the Internet had asked me a while ago about a doll, a Barbie doll, being found in the cellar as well. Mm-hmm. I don't recall ever seeing any photographic evidence of that, and I don't know that really has any bearing on the investigation. It's in the basement. There are toys all over the place.
Got it.
It's just a matter of speculation, and I don't think it adds any probative value to whether or not something like that was there or not. And I personally didn't see anything that would suggest that.
Are you still doing presentations for your book? I hope there's people still calling you and you're still able to talk about it.
I have not. I did a second follow-up presentation at the Wilkinson Public Library. I was hoping that we had broken it up into more digestible pieces of presentation versus the one that was done back in October 2012. Mm-hmm. And we had some technical difficulties with that. And so the only stuff that's out there on the Internet, YouTube right now, is parts of the presentation that I made back in 2012. And that was kind of a meet and greet. I talked about my writing experience as a meet the author event versus a presentation on the JonBenet Ramsey murder investigation. At some point, maybe I'll do something else. With some assistance of an ABC producer, talked to some of the networks about doing something a little bit more in-depth, similar to what Lou Smith did with Katie Couric, but so
oh,
far
see, that would. Oh, we got to get that going. That would be just phenomenal to finally get it out there in the mainstream, just to get the truth out there. Chief Kohler, how is your book doing? Is it? I think around Christmas the sales will pick up. I hope things are going well for you in that arena.
Well, some of the Kindle sales have helped since that was released in June, and. Mm-hmm. Thanks to the person who helped make that a reality, because I just wasn't able to get it accomplished. I had contacted some professional folks on the Internet to try to get it done. It just didn't happen. And I recognize the individual in that Kindle version for all the volunteer time that they put into making that come true. So thank you so much.
Right. And okay, let's, Cynic, I think Chief Kohler, he's probably getting a little tired here. I think I've covered everything in the chat room because a lot of the questions that we had were answered with what we've been discussing, so that's good. So, Cynic, I'm going to let you wrap it up, my dear. What is your final question?
Well, you mean I can't proceed with my 2 hours of questions?
I know. No. Someday you will. I promise.
No. Actually, I don't really have much left here. I appreciate all the time that you've given us, Chief Kohler. Essentially, again, it kind of goes back to the mainstream media and the coverage that I've been watching, and over again, I've heard legal pundits and seen legal pundits comment on the fact that they have never, not once, heard of a district attorney calling together a grand jury and then, then refusing to proceed. Isn't the simple answer to that question the fact that Alex Hunter did not want that grand jury he was feeling a lot of pressure. Let's face it, Steve Thomas had resigned. There's pressure from Steve Thomas. There's pressure from the public, pressure from the governor. He put that grand jury together, and he was just hoping and praying that there would not be an indictment. And again, I'm a little bit disappointed that this sort of information doesn't come out, and I think that's the honest answer to that issue. And it's just unfortunate that you see these people scratching their heads. Well, you know, why did this happen? How does the DA, call together a grand jury and just say, oh, well, no, not going to go ahead on it?
Well, it's an interesting question. We talked about the Thames-Micah case, Sid Wells' murder.
Yes.
And, Steve Thomas speaks to that in his book. And I have to tell you, I didn't address it in mine, but I was on the executive board of the Boulder Police Benefit Association at the time that case was being investigated, the Sid Wells homicide. And by some hap circumstance, we received materials through some correspondence that came to our association. And it was an agreement between defense attorneys and the DA's office that indicated that they would not ask certain questions in the grand jury process. And our executive board debated long and hard about taking that information to the public as to, what type of steps the DA's office was taking to not solve that case. You know, it's pretty incredulous to think that you would call a grand jury to investigate a murder investigation and then agree with the defense not to ask certain questions of witnesses. And, I draw the comparison to the interview that blew me out of a chair in 1998 when one of the defense attorneys for the Ramsey team mentioned that the DA's office had agreed not to pursue certain records in this instance in the John Benet murder investigation, calling them an island of privacy, that the family deserved some degree of privacy in this investigation, and that the DA's office had agreed not to pursue certain records. Well, I think that those records hold the key to this murder investigation, mm-hmm. and you can read between the lines in my book, my treatise of this case, and I think that's where the answer lies and that's where the resolution lies. But those records are probably beyond our reach legally here in the state of Colorado, perhaps not in another state, but that is kind of the history, I think, that we've seen and complained about with the regime that operated under Alex Hunter's tenure at the DA's office. And regrettably, at the time, we thought it was too complicated an issue for the public to understand, and we didn't take that out. People voted Alex in for years and years as a continuing DA, and unfortunately, I think the result that we saw was an ineffectual prosecution of or an investigation of this case based on the DA's handling of it at the time.
Okay, Cynic, you have one more comment/question. I'll let you do it, and then we need to wrap it up.
All right. First of all, I'll say once again, thanks, Chief Kohler, for your time here, and I'm sure everyone appreciates all that you've had to say in your book and on the numerous shows that you've done, graciously giving your time to Tricia. And I hope that, in the future that you get an opportunity to speak to the mainstream media and perhaps, get the truth out there than some of the spin that's been going around. My final comment/question, however, goes back to something that you'd mentioned about the fact that Lou Smith testified before the grand jury, which also, John Douglas, I believe, testified before the grand jury. And so I think between the two of them, there was a tremendous amount of contrary information or the intruder theory, whichever way you want to put it, that was put forth to these jurors. And that's, in and of itself, that's a bit unusual in a grand jury setting. It's usually a more or less a one-sided prosecutorial biased sort of presentation. But in this particular case, there was a tremendous amount of sort of intruder did it sort of theory presented to these people, and they rejected all of that. And that's, to me, is just extraordinary. And that's also something that's not mentioned by the mainstream media.
You know, I can only comment on the grand jury testimony of Lou Smith because it was reported in the mainstream media, the Boulder Daily Camera. So as far as any other testimony provided there, I'm unable to do that.
Still, even if it was only Lou Smith, and I'm not going to put you on the spot, but I think I'm pretty positive. The John Douglas thing. I'm not privy to any secret grand jury proceedings. Believe me, I'm positive that was publicly noted. But regardless, if you don't wish to comment, then that's not a problem. But even in and of itself, I'm sure Lou's testimony's presentation was fairly extensive. And as I say, you just sort of have almost like a kind of a defense attorney-style presentation within a grand jury setting is unusual. And that's something that I think also the mainstream media should comment on, that, that indictment was extraordinary given the type of presentation it was given, I think.
Well, I agree, and that's the point I tried to make in counterpoint to Lynn Wood's comments, was that, the jury did hear the intruder theory, and Lou Smith was the author and the advocate and the proponent of that, and he presented, I'm sure, every bit of evidence that he had that would point to an intruder, and it still did not sway the grand jurors in that situation, and they voted to indict on two different counts.
And that is the absolute truth. Everybody, we need to get that out there. So when we're out and about on the forums, let's remind everybody that in this very unusual situation with Lou Smith, he was allowed to go and testify for the defense. That is not what happens in a grand jury. It's a one-sided presentation. So even after hearing from Lou Smith with his big PowerPoint presentation, they still voted to indict, and that's very important. Chief Kohler, again, thank you so much for all you do and all you have done. We're here to help you any way we can, and you're always greatly appreciated when you come on the show and take time out of your busy schedule to answer questions for people like us. We could keep you on here all night, but I promise you we won't, okay?
Thank you.
Take care, Chief. Take care. Cynic, right. Thank you so much, my dear. And thank you to everybody in the chat room and to everybody who's listening. And Michael, my co-host who disappeared on me, just ran away. That's okay. I've been abandoned before. Anyway, we'll be back next week. We have a great show. But once again, it's time to present you with some legal goo. The opinions expressed on Trisha's True Crime Radio are those of the hosts and guests. Do keep that in mind. Trisha's True Crime Radio is a completely separate entity from websleuth.com LLC and formsforjustice.org. So in other words, if your brain gets in a twist because you're so mad about something you hear on Trisha's True Crime Radio, you come to moi, Trisha, and we'll make you happy all again. It's Trisha's True Crime Radio, where we discuss true crime and current events. We always do it with common sense. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.